Okay,
this is part three of our Real House Gaga's review of the November 30th, 2011 show. It's copyright New Grandview Incorporated, all rights reserved. And we're starting at 10:35 a.m. Hawaii time. Okay, Allison, take it away. Oh, wait, we should say we're at about the 20-minute mark of the second hour.
Exactly, 29
over. Okay.
Okay, here we go.
They think that obfuscates their muscle tone.
Right, so you say, again, we veer into a serious area here. Lipids are the key thing in RNA drops. They're a major factor in our bodies that Ian talks about.
Yes.
So the fat, we want fat to have more lipids?
No, you want lipids to be fluid in your meat sack body, but you don't have to have an abundance of it to have the fractal to be synced up.
Right, the fractal. Note that, people, the use of the word fractal. So the Ian just said we don't want any fat. Remember, he just said that a second ago. He said none. I think he means don't worry about measuring how much you have.
That's right. That's good.
Right.
Good, Bob.
So Matthew was talking about his index and this, and people were saying it's got down. It's impossible how low it got in the RNA drop effect. Right, Carol? Wasn't that?
No. He's hot. He really is. He's got a 12-pack.
So the idea is to get rid of a lot of the fat, but still keep enough to get the conductivity going, or the flow.
It's more the fat in your bloodstream, and it's the good fats in the bloodstream that keep things flowing. But you know, the fat outside on your body. I agree with 5 pounds overweight to keep your
breast big.
Yeah, right.
Good point, Bob. Good point. Now, no more titty flashes for Bob, Carol. He's getting excited.
So, carry on, Carol. I interrupted. What were we going to say? You agree 500 pounds more for?
For women, for hormones, because we make our hormones from fat. But in the bloodstream, I don't know, we get so many diluted fats or synthetic fats that a lot of people get thick blood now. So a lot of them are being put on blood thinners.
Now, I am probably, may not, may. Do you agree with that statement that synthetic fats create whatever Carolyn just said is a disservice?
I don't care.
See, I don't care.
If you get to 1%, you won't notice.
Okay.
1% of what?
As opposed to the 99.
Oh, yeah.
The 99?
That's very interesting. The 99.
Oh, it's a metaphor, what he just said. He made a metaphor of the amount of stuff he had.
Damn, non-physical.
You have 1% of everything.
Okay, so.
No, right. You get that, Carol?
No, yes, but there's another point here. Hold on. Okay, so everybody's running around. They want to have more energy because they're tired and listless, and they poop out at parties, and they can't find Lucille Ball's Vitamita Vegemin. We could do that, but it's not necessary here.
Yeah.
They want this buildup or increase of energy, okay? Well, that's stored in what they call fat. When you have energy that you can't use, your body stores it in the form of fat. So quit trying to activate this energy bit, because apparently it's more, the only reason you would gain body fat is that it, you have more energy than you're using.
Ah,
okay.
So when people say they get energy from RNA drops, that's a misinterpretation of what's really going on, because you're saying you don't want more energy.
Then it won't be, when they say that, it won't be long, because they'll say, I gained 4 pounds.
Isn't this interesting, James? Before, Ian is discouraging people desiring energy.
Listen to this part real close. And it's more than your
James?
Listen to this part real. I'm listening to this part real close. This is new information. Go ahead.
Well, thanks for interrupting you.
Okay, next topic.
Yeah, see ya.
Do we want to stop there and say anything? Or?
Yeah, let's. Let me just turn up the volume here just a second.
I could listen to that clip over and over.
Yeah, it's, you know, like, I've never been in public and then talk about women's breasts. I don't have the words, so I just go breast big. You know what I mean? Like, I forget either the speed of it, not to interrupt, but that's how I understand why I just go, rather than saying, women want to have big breasts. I just go breast big, like it's a syndrome.
Well, isn't it the men that want the women to have big breasts?
I know both. Women want it for sculptural effect. You want to be well sculptured. That's what McLuhan used to say, that nakedness, that nudity was not nakedness, it was sculptural. So the Playboy foldout in the 60s everybody would look at was a sculptural art form, not an issue of nakedness.
It was art, huh?
Yeah, the shape, the women want their bodies to look curvy and bound, having boundaries and whatever the words are for sculptural effect. And that also would be tactile.
But doesn't that depend on the culture or the
time? Yes.
Like, I mean, in the 1920s, it was a thing to have no breasts. Women bound up their breasts, so they were flat-chested.
Right. No, that's the sensory ratios on the crowd level, the profile of the crowd, which was McLuhan's definition of number. There is a shifting crowd images, a requirement of crowd images caused by the medium of the day. So television was more tactile than radio. They're both electric. They're both tactile on that level. But the fact you could see the bounding line, McLuhan called it, in the TV image, couldn't see anything with radio, that made the whole population, at least in North America or the West, express that shift by trying to be more tactile. And so that explained the beehive hairdos and the new emphasis on the Jane Russell bra. Maybe it was the Jane Russell bra. This whole posturing that started to happen. That was the American kinetic visual bias. That's what they were born with because they were the only country built on the printing press and then industry. That bias adapted the tactile, responded to the tactile mosaic effect of television by shaping their chemical bodies with sculptural form. That's what McLuhan was saying. You'd see, you know, and then all the changes in science and art, changes all across the spectrum of human and culture and activities is how you note that a medium has come into a society because, you know, it started these new preferences and these changes and desires are an effect of the new form, though people don't know it's the new form. But they don't know the characteristics of the new form. So you see there's a change going on because all the old forms adjust. So you go from flat in the radio era to buxom in the 50s and 60s.
But I mean, wasn't a new form when Rubens, the painter, came on the scene? I mean, he started painting women that would be considered today overweight with large.
Oh yeah, see that's an oral culture starting to be visual through the printing press. So whatever the sensory mix was that 300 years ago? You know, a long time ago. I wasn't around, so I don't know the particular sensory mix, but we know they're basically a society that's just becoming eye-oriented. And so you're saying that the popularity, the image was to be overweight in Rubens' day?
Well, yeah, like well-endowed and somewhat, by today's standards, would be overweight. I mean,
right. Now, that would be, see, the McLuhan said that the pyramids came in when we went from tactile, aboriginal spaces, which we would see as very intuitive and like almost having ESP. Then when the early parts of writing, not the phonetic alphabet, but the beginning of visualized space, McLuhan theorized that pyramids expressed that, these huge sculptural forms that were filling up a huge space. Because when they first started to think of visual boundaries, it was huge because they were coming from a non-visual, extreme non-visual. So I'm thinking that the oral feudal society, when they started to encounter visual space, the British culture, the French culture, whatever, translated that in maintaining a huge overweight feminine body. That's how you theorize. That's how you apply McLuhan's formula. I'm not saying it's right.
I have a quick question, Sheila. Would you have seen that as, since most of those paintings of the time when they were created were only seen by the highest up, right, the upper echelons, you wouldn't, you know, was that?
Well, no, because he painted in the churches. I mean, churches would have had every segment of society in.
Would they?
So.
Anybody could go into a church, huh?
That's my assumption. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
I wondered if the question really was about the influence of the painting, because my take on it would be that it wasn't being seen by, you know, the same quantity of people that the printing press affected, of course. So
right. The printing press brought in the idea of sitting for a self-portrait. That had never occurred to anybody before the printing press.
And as it was the body influenced, was what we were desiring our bodies to look like influenced by what we're seeing in that era, or were they being depicted by what was? In other words, was Reuben painting a Rubenesque figure because that's what was walking around, or was that
what they desired, what the person said, make me look big? Because maybe on the practical level, women had to look like they could give birth to a lot of kids or something. You know what I mean? They had to look well-nourished, or that's what people thought was well-nourished.
Well, that goes back to, like, you know, when you were in the First World War and that period where it really wasn't attractive. You were considered poor if you were looked undernourished, because that meant you couldn't afford to eat.
Right. So why did the flat look come in then?
Yeah, that's odd. Well, your explanation of radio, possibly.
Right.
I don't know.
It was like...
It wasn't flat in right after the World War. It was flat during the 60s, the Twiggy thing.
No, it was flat during the flapper, which would be the...
Yeah, the flappers are very flat. I remember them as flat.
Mm-hmm, they, right.
And that could have been the chemical body responding to the shock of the discarnate. The electrified thing is coming with the telephone and the telegraph.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just it was an early attempt to drop, to put no significance into the physical body, but to have feel this other space. And what came in was that, what's the dance called back then, the cakewalk?
I don't know, the Charleston?
The Charleston, right, right. And these different dances, people had to look in America in hyperkinetic. Like McLuhan said, the dance is the main cultural form of America, because it's an industrialized kinetic society. So the one thing that America stands out on is changing, creating new dances all the time. It's a hyperactivity to fill
like
in.
One, just quickly, Bob, was, you know, it would be a bit difficult to do that dance if you had big breasts.
Right.
One thing.
Yeah, the way the arms go, yeah.
Right, but I was realizing the way I view it is through the clothing. I've always looked at body types, and that creates another scenario. Is the clothing adapting to the body type, or is the body type adapting to the clothing? Because the clothing of that period was really straight up and down, too. So
right.
It would have ruined the line of how it looked if you had big breasts.
Right, and why did the preference for that kind of clothes come in? McLuhan would say it would be due to the communication environment. The media environment would make a preference in a kinetic society to have that vertical, whatever you call that kind of clothing. See, so it's
mm-hmm.
it's affecting the clothing desire, the body shape. All these factors are inside the mold, the molding, the sculpting of the media preference. So I would look at dances as America went more tactile with the electric technology. When in tactile space doesn't move anywhere, it's resonant. It's, quote, like emanates, but that's not even the right term. Anyways, it's in touch with everything. That's tactile. It's like your central nervous system. Electricity extends the central nervous system. So you have a kind of sensory fundamentalism that happens in American culture. They're basically kinetic, so they want to prop up the kinetic aspect of themselves as it gets threatened by the new tactility. So they go hyper and start dancing a lot. Like puppets. You know, look at it as a puppetry kind of situation. The puppets freak out.
They need a lot of energy.
What?
Yeah, they need a lot of energy.
Okay, now that gets into the next part.
Yeah, well, the burning of energy, and I, when we, after listening to this a couple times, it seemed that what people wanted to know was, that you were bringing up, Bob, was, you know, do you have to move to spend the energy? What is it that you do to spend the energy? And it sounds to me like you don't have to do anything.
Right.
You know how to use it internally. I can remember the most weight I ever lost, I had nothing to do with exercising. It was the churning of drama going in inside my physical body.
Some emotional crisis, you mean?
Yeah.
You lose weight.
Yes. So that made me realize that's like, and you can lose weight, you know, when you're in a hospital bed. I mean, you're not moving. So it really isn't movement externally that creates, you know, how we always think of exercise as being or just movement.
Right. So that.
Again, is a very American thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Exercise thing, very American.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, well, that's because they think the kinetic sense means you're a bona fide American.
Oh.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know about energy the way Ion described it until the November 30 show, or I might have thought intuitive, but I'm not sure. Let's say I didn't know. Now that I know that energy is not a factor as defined by Ion, I then retrospectively think of the Americans as a kinetic society, and they've always interpreted energy within their cultural framework of a kinetic movement thing, whereas other cultures probably interpret energy another way, with a different sensory bias. All of them are miscalculating about what energy is.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you look at the Japanese culture, the Chinese culture, maybe they got to do their Tai Chi, right? They got to do that kind of balancing, proprioceptive balance. They think that affects their energy, or maybe they don't even think of it in terms of energy. So you're right. This energy is a really American concept or an industrial society concept.
Yeah,
energy through movement.
Yeah.
Yeah, try to find a gym in Paris.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what do the French do for energy, if you can even think of it, Sheila?
I don't think they even put their attention on it.
Well, what do they put their attention on?
Eating.
Food.
Really, eating?
Really good food and looking well.
Does that mean healthy or looking glamorous and flashy and up to date?
It doesn't mean healthy.
So they're like, McLuhan said tribal societies, you know, pre-literate, were into costumes and color. You know, just look at the fantastic costumes in African societies and all that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems the French, being literate, they're the most tribal, looking flashy like tribal societies. They're into the color and tactility. They seem to be a holdover from that. And McLuhan said the French had an acoustic bias and the English had a visual bias. So the English, to express a sense of mastery, said, I know it like the back of my hand. So you look at the back of your hand. So that's a visual bias. Whereas the French say, I know it au fond, A-U-F-O-N-D. Do you know what that means, Sheila, au fond?
Well, that means I know it deeply.
Right.
I know
it deeply, and McLuhan called that an acoustic bias, but it's not visual. It's like knowing it, they do conversations deeply. They like the resonant interval aspect. They like the echoing and resonance of social interaction, but that also goes with non-visual bias, and so they look into the surface of their clothing. They want their clothes look flashy, or they're very conscious of it. But it's damped down compared to a truly pre-literate society. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's not just their clothes. It's like their house and everything.
Their environment, right. They want
their environment.
They're very sensitive to their environment, whereas they say the English, who are visually biased, don't care about food. They don't care about the other senses.
And they don't care about the environment either. That doesn't make sense to me if they're visually biased. They don't, you know.
Right. See, what visually biased doesn't mean your eyeball is noticing colors like a painter. A painter is a tactile culture compared to the visual. What the visual means is the black and white limited reductionist color scheme of the book.
Okay.
And it's abstract.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's abstract. It's actually what we call what? A nerd kind of thing that's not really aware of their bodies. They're in abstract mathematical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the terminology he uses confuses people, but if you have me around to explain it, then you can understand it.
Then we're good.
Yeah, because there was a headline of an article, McLuhan saying, color is not a visual medium. Can you imagine the average person? What?
Well, actually, that's interesting because Ion says I'm very visceral, and I'm not that visual, which is bizarre to me because I'm a painter. So, yeah, I guess.
Right, but see, you're using your eyes deeply, involved
yeah,
with the other
okay.
senses, not abstractly.
Right, okay. Cool.
Yeah,
wow,
that's good. You're, beg your pardon?
I said I just learned something new. I mean, I got it. I get it now.
Yeah, now you can read McLuhan and know what he means. And actually, it may be accurate the way he says it. If you know that you can be, you know, visceral, proprioceptive, and non-abstract and be involved with eyeball activity.
Right. Don't you love that, Sheila? Now you can read McLuhan.
I know you were thinking the same thing. No, but I can understand Bob.
Bob's bias, yes.
What did you say? What did you say, Alton? What are you laughing at?
That was very sweet because your bias is that now that she's heard that, now she'll be able to read McLuhan.
Yeah. And now you're.
She had a profound moment about herself, but now your bias is she can now read McLuhan.
Yeah, the only reason to live, the only reason to live is to be able to read. You now have a green card. You know, a full American citizen, you can vote.
What a relief. Wow. It's all good.
Well, did you see my post yesterday? What did I call it? But I said the first ion, the first rogue ion, the first ion thing that he did last April on his own was 2 hours of McLuhan. And I re-listened to McLuhan, and this really is, he's describing the concepts, quote, concepts that ion, that prepares you to understand ion. That's why ion called it moi, Marshall on ion.
Oh.
I mean, I'm thinking as I was listening, I said, yeah, McLuhan's the only guy who's preparing you to get rid of your visual bias, which is what ion's all about. What you see is not real, you know, and it just struck me how appropriate it is McLuhan was. I can't look it up.
How did it come up with you and McLuhan and Ion? Were you talking about McLuhan first? Was Ion same, or was it a seamless entrance just as you went through?
No, it was a key. It was a key point. Somewhere in the early months, after I got familiar with whatever Ion was saying back then, the basic themes, it sounded a bit like McLuhan to me, and I think it's a Dark Ages thing. I said. When were the Dark Ages? And he said, oh, after the Bible, after the King James Bible. And I go, wait a minute. The Dark Ages is before the printing press, right? That's the normal historical statement. It's before the printing press, you know, 800 A.D., 500 A.D., correct? You know, they talk about the Dark Ages and, you know, after Rome collapses. And he's saying the Dark Ages begin after the Bible's printed. I say, well, why are you calling that the Dark Ages? And he said because of – he didn't – I don't know what he said. But what I – so then I go, wait a minute. That's when the printing press started. Are you saying that the whole period of Gutenberg science and book stuff is a Dark Age? And he said, yes. And I said, well, that's what McLuhan says. And I don't know if I've been looking for McLuhan stuff earlier. I might have. But that was the key thing when he said the printing press had a huge disservice, and McLuhan had written about that. McLuhan didn't say the printing press was completely a disservice. There were services to it, but there was a huge disservice that literate people didn't recognize. So then, so I knew that, and then I don't think it came up much. If it did, Ion would say, forget McLuhan. And I think I've explained this publicly before.
I remember those days. Talking about McLuhan,
right.
McLuhan allowed.
Right, and you would have heard that a bit in the early tailgate, I think, if I ever brought it up. And everybody thought, yeah, McLuhan's an asshole. But I now know that Ion wanted me and Carolyn to get its message first, right?
Oh.
That's the point, get what it was saying. So what turned it around was, what was it? Well, it might have been the Dark Ages idea, something like that. I said, wait a minute, that's the effect of printing press. And I said, that's McLuhan. He said, well, you can, we concede that a little bit, but you can't mention McLuhan. So that went on a few months. And then you might get into the fall of 2009, six, seven, 8 months, and then Ian one day said, you know, Bob, they just announced it out of the blue. We like your five-bodied notion. We like that. We're going to use it. And that surprised me that they were going to acknowledge that. I don't even think they said the chart. They just said the five-bodied. And I said, well, if you're going to use the five-bodied, you've got to use McLuhan because that's the background to understanding how you get five bodies. And Ion sort of, you know, maybe went quiet for a second and said, okay, you can bring up McLuhan, but here's the rule. Whenever you quote McLuhan, you say the McLuhan stuff, then you got to go, however, Bob says, that was the rule.
did they tell you that privately?
This was not said on the radio. This is a private. I used to have many hours with Ion by myself. Often, Karen would be there for the first two or three hours, and then she'd go to bed, and I'd carry on for another couple of hours. So it was not uncommon to have a six, seven-hour session every night with me and Ion. You know, Karen would be for the first half of it. So it was in that. I know I was alone when he said this. He said, okay, we'll tolerate you saying that terrible word, McLuhan, if you erase it by going however Bob says and then move it into the five bodies. So that was the rule. Then the next thing is the encounter with Ed when we do the revelations. To me, that's the next point where McLuhan becomes a sticking point and Ed will object to it. But I'm saying, wait a minute, even the first few chapters seems to have the printed book effect. I mean, no one else would hear it, but I knew enough about McLuhan to get that was in there. And then we get to session 12, chapter 12 or something. You guys should have heard it. When I go, wait a minute, that's the printing press. That's America being built in the printing press. That whole insight in the revelations, like halfway through the revelations, that's when McLuhan started to, I mean, that's when Ion, you know, didn't mind me going McLuhan. He was like waiting until I got to that part and then recognized it. Then that was the context to appreciate McLuhan. Do you remember that?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Sheila has heard it. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. He knew. We'll get to that. But no, Sheila, you remember that part of the Bible. Have you heard all the revelations, Allison?
No.
Okay.
I have not.
But you remember that, Sheila, when he starts to acknowledge the printing press and how that really made America different?
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Yeah, and that was why Christianity was the only religion that went around the world. This is the difference of John's vision from the Emerald Tablets. You know, he had the eternal wisdom that was in the Emerald Tablets and whatever other sources of knowledge or the oral wisdom, oral tradition. But the fact is that John could see that this strange phenomenon, these Christians here, was going to spread around the globe, and that was what the Book of Revelation is all about. Is about that strange media effect. So that's why Christianity, it was an extra burden that it was going to be a religion spread around the world, which had never, no one even wanted to do that before. And it would only spread because of the printing press.
I agree with the extra burden.
Yeah. Yeah, they talk about the white man's burden, and they think of it in terms of racism, but actually it's a media dynamic. And then that also explains Nostradamus, how he could see all that technologies, because he was in the stream of Western culture, and a lot of what he saw was the same thing that John saw.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how this issue, that's what happened. That's how it came up.
It seems like Ion knew that you knew so much. You thought you knew. No, you knew so much about McLuhan that if they allowed that to start from the beginning, it might cloud how you worked with Ion.
I know. I agree. I see it that way. Imagine me going on about if that was accepted before we even went public, I would have been emphasizing that too much, and people wouldn't get the true Ion stuff, because Ion does go past McLuhan. It completes McLuhan. It goes beyond that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But in the world of social knowledge and mortar knowledge, McLuhan's really important. And so it kind of got confirmed to me when he did his first Rogue Ion, or Moi, show. He featured 2 hours of McLuhan. And I re-listened to it yesterday for some reason. There's a lot of Ionic stuff. It's really interesting when you know Ion and then see what McLuhan was doing. He was the only guy who was eligible to be quoted.
Amazing.
Cool.
Yeah. So let's go into the energy thing. Like, what did you think? Allison, as you heard this the first time.
It was fantastic. It was, you know, absolutely turned the world upside down, as James was noting. You know, it was everything that we've, at least Americans, as you said,
right.
Sheila,
you know,
as an American perspective. I mean, I've always looked at your physicality as not being something that is controlled by what we thought it was, though. Because it, just for those reasons, as Ian said, you can look at, you know, a runner who, they have no energy. Because they're constantly, I have a really, really thin sister, and she doesn't have any energy ever. And I think it's probably because she spends it all. But
she
it's interesting. What's the reservoir? As they mentioned, balance is it. So...
Yeah, what does she spend it on?
That's a good question.
So?
Activity, it seems like constant internal activity. If I had to look at it, at who I know and what their size is compared to my version of their level of, you know, inner peace or quietness inside, you're pretty thin, aren't you, Bob?
Yeah.
It's a lot of interactivity.
No, I figured that. I figured that I do so much thinking or reviewing conversations I have or something. I've always done that. That's how.
I looked at metabolism. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, and so I've always seen partly the reason I'm thin is that because I was working a lot inside. So I never really maybe thought it through, but I thought I was burning off energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what I was doing. But it seems that working on yourself, doing something with yourself, your self-image is a factor here in your weight, in your, how overweight or not you are, or your sense of vitality.
Hmm. What do you think of that one, Sheila?
Well, Ian also said in that cash flow that someone said why something about that Vogue has something to do why women think they need to be thin, or there's a belief around that I have to be thin to be beautiful,
which is just a meme.
So, that's the meme. So there's more to it than meets the eye.
Mm.
So if you have that belief, then if you think you're not beautiful, does that mean you just gain weight? I don't know.
Is it something to do about being mobile?
That's what I was bringing up before. I don't think it is. I think that's, you know, you seem to say that in cash flow. I heard that, Bob, too, where you're like, is it, you know, the people lifting barbells, they just sit around in between, you know, the times that they're lifting. And Ian said, yeah, they have to get massages and, you know, do all that kind of stuff. But it seems like it's not just external movement
No. That
spends energy. It's internal movement. That's why I lift up metabolism.
Hey, maybe it's the 90% of yourself that's non-physical. That's your real action. Like Ian will talk about diseases, and it's always diseases are dealing with our responses in the chemical level to all this drama that's going on in your non-physical, right? So that's
mm-hmm.
where the energy, that's where the drama, that's where your body image and your poise and happiness meter is really involved in your non-physical, because that's the majority of you. See, that's a good idea. It's in the non-physical where this determining of whether I get energy or not happens. And it's not energy in the chemical level because it's non-physical.
That sounds supportable.
Yeah, it's like modulating the frequency, the magnetism, the polarity, and the conductivity. Those four factors and the vectors are really what your non-physical is engaged in.
Hmm.
And that can't be lumped under the term energy.
When I heard this, first heard this, I was actually, Terry and I have talked about this before, but going into the parallel worlding and being so active there that you wake up much thinner.
Has she said that's happened, or is she speculating that would happen?
No. We were kind of joking about it, but.
Well, the main thing Ion says about that is that when you wake up tired in the morning, it doesn't mean that you didn't save your energy, you didn't get a nice, relaxing sleep. It means you were very busy on the other world.
Mm-hmm.
And
but also
that
you take your body with you to the other worlds.
Yeah.
So.
And also you're non-physical.
Okay. But.
Here's the thing. I find that Ion takes the cliche, which some people get from religions, that we live forever, it might be in heaven, but we don't die, we reincarnate, all these terms. Ion takes the actual idea that you live forever and applies it all across the board, all across life, all across the concepts. And so if you're eternal, you wouldn't have an energy vector, right? There's no motor keeping you eternal. So actually, Ion applies and then says, if you're eternal, then there's no wall, there's no boundaries, there's just frequency shifts. Therefore, you could be shifting into another world very subtly, not even notice it, because there's no container, a wall around the situation to control your energy or your perceptions. See, that's the actual physical implications if you truly understand that you're eternal. And what's interesting about electricity may be very close to the non-physical, and it makes things go on forever. I mean, our technologies carry on quite abundantly once they've been electrified. So electricity's... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I remember in Jesse's session, they were talking about electricity, and there was some light bulb moment that you heard where Ion had never said that they were electricity?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because electricity is the closest to an energized or vital, frequency-laden, non-physical. Because the scientists claim they don't know what electricity is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure what they have to know what it is, but it's a cliche that nobody's figured out what electricity is because it's not measurable. You can't put it into eyeball terms. You can't... say completely what it is because it's not limited to the visual, and that's why I say it's kind of like tactility, though Ion defines tactility as contrast, it bouncing up against some other frequency. So maybe electricity can't be limited to tactile, but my definition, McLuhan's definition of tactility is not a sense, but the interplay of senses. That interplay sounds like electricity.
And Ion didn't say that they were only electricity. They
just
said that that's the closest thing, the way that
right.
he could describe it. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's why the guff is empty over the last 150 years, because we have externalized electricity as a technical environment. That would be the beginning of the second coming. Second coming being this radical thing that the Evergreens defined as a time of perpetual change. That's been the fate of the Western world and eventually the Asian world for the last 150 years. Is the society got faster and faster? You see it said in the 20s, you see it said in the 50s and the 80s, and then now, right? The speed up, which is really that's a kinetic image. That's movement through space. It's actually not speeding up. It's implosion is the better word, where people get, quote, more connected. Technically. So that imploding, it's been going on and knocking out the walls that printing press created, the visual space walls, they've been eroding for 150 years as every new extension of electricity came in.
And if most people, if you ask them, I bet they would say electricity is energy.
Right. And what do they think it means, energy? You know, they always try to get it. They try to... they can have too much energy. If you actually force them to think about it, it's like the word electricity. They couldn't really define what it is, or they couldn't determine exactly what makes you get more energy. They might have a temporary solution, like people say RNA drops give you energy, or some people say it that way. Often they say more clarity. But often it flips out of that, and then you puzzle, why don't I have my energy anymore? So then you have to confront the fact that the energy is not just caused by a substance. Then people say, well, I got depressed. You can see them oscillating between the mind, the body, and the emotions in gauging where their energy barometer is.
Only from the reference point that they've used always before. I mean.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to mention, yep, there's a new testimonial. Did you hear it about RNA drops? This Lisa,
yeah,
you know, brought her boyfriend, whatever he is, husband, whatever, back from the dead. Did you hear about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard it.
Now, what's going on there? What is that energy? I don't think so. It's all the factors of human beingness, you know, that are being affected by the RNA drops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't see it as energy.
No. It revitalized something. So
mm-hmm.
the point is that Ion goes on, and Carolyn discusses it with him for the rest of that hour, right? The energy factor, the
mm-hmm.
what is energy and how our terms are not adequate. And so I like to sum it up this way. If you're eternal, then energy is not a factor. And so that's how I understand Ion is correct in pointing out that energy is not something you should be concerned about. And you don't need to have food to have energy.
Right.
And I just got a metaphor as we're talking about it, plugging into the non-physical or plugging into your energy when you were saying that guy was brought back from the dead.
Yeah.
If you're connecting, you know, to that, it's not energy, it just is you. But once
that's
that
right.
connection is clean and not questioned and doesn't need a plug anymore or a cord or an explanation, it's unlimited.
Yeah, and also she weans him off the drugs that the medical profession had stuck in him. And the less drugs he required or even took, whether he required it or not, he got better. See, there's this scientific, you know, it's interesting how Ion is so disrespectful of science. And you can understand that when you bring in McLuhan and say, yeah, that's a visual bias, the visual measuring, you know, where does it show on the meter? All that extension of the eye that the science enterprise is more and more contradicted by a non-visual, non-eyeball society. And you see people groping around most of the 20th century looking for other models of the big picture of themselves. They don't, the visual is not adequate. That's why it was popular in the 50s to say, you know, you got to get out of your mind, you know, get rid of your mind chatter. That was just visual chatter in your mind, visualization. And then people talked about visualizing, not alphabetical, but kind of proprioceptive and pictorially visually, not, you know, like photographically visualize. They would try to visualize health or visualize world peace, right? That's turning their brain into a movie, so to speak. That's different from the limited pages of a book. Now, we're not saying books are bad. They're just a particular kind of sensory abstraction that are fun to engage, but you can't base all your cosmos on that, on just the book experience as the ultimate archetype.
Thank God.
Yeah, so here's what I posted yesterday. I said, preparatory to enjoying Ion's Book of Revelation series. And I say, in the first episode, April 19th, 2011, of Ion's solo productions titled Moi, M-O-I, French for me, Ion features 104 minutes of talk by Marshall McLuhan, then translates Moi at the end as, quote, Marshall on Ion. So then I transcribed a section. Here's what McLuhan said. And he's saying this to the American Booksellers Association in June 1969 at the launching of The Love Machine by Jacqueline Suzanne. That was the day she launched it. They had big hopes for her book, the American Booksellers industry. And so McLuhan makes fun of it, mocks the book. And he said, I did this in The Mechanical Bride back in the 40s. And the book came out in 1951, but he was writing it, he said, by 1940. So The Love Machine, he was saying the electric age is not made up of machines. Machines are a mechanical era, the Gutenberg era. So here's what he says. Anything that undermines the phonetic alphabet, and that would be electricity, anything that undermines the phonetic alphabet and its dominance and its power of releasing the eye as the dominant organ ends civilization. There are lots of things better than civilization, but if you like civilization, that's the end of it. You know, when you supersede the phonetic alphabet. He says, civilization is a technical term based upon the dominance of the eye over the other senses. We live in an electric age, which is non-visual and non-visualizable. And the chemical bond, as taught to us by Linus Pauling, famous scientist, Heisenberg and others, is interval. So the non-visual, non-visualizable is interval, comma, resonance. The quantum mechanics boys have been telling us for 50 years that the bond of being, the thing that holds the world together, is sound or resonance. There are no connections in matter, nothing that can be called a connection, only resonance. Our DNA boys and our NASA boys still try to visualize space, meaning they have no relation whatever to the science they talk about. So you notice how he puts down the DNA guys? Now, when you've heard enough of the revelations, you know the meaning of that.
Wow, that was, when did he say all this?
In June 1969.
Wow.
But he wrote this in his books in the 50s. This is just him speaking. He's famous in the late 60s, so he's speaking all over the place. And we have a recording of, Ion found this recording on the internet, and it's very good. It covers a lot of McLuhan's themes. And this part, I just thought was worth typing out because it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
So here, then I post, I say that is at about the 42-minute mark, just after the 42-minute mark, you hear what I just read. But then I say, continue at the 47-minute mark. Actually, McLuhan explains how every death is a suicide. He doesn't say that aphorism, but he explains it in relation to a violent quest for identity, to find out who am I. But I don't want to go into any more of that, just that I can see that why every death is a suicide is expressed by an identity crisis. People who die, who commit suicide, are trying to find who they are. They've lost their sense of who they are, so they want to change themselves. So the way to change yourself is to leave this dimension. Right?
That's a big change, all right.
Yeah, and then it's a dramatic, a violent quest for identity. And then I said the second point he says is, I say, why Ion pick Canadians to promote Ion. So that would be McLuhan and me and Carolyn. He goes into what Canada is, its sensibility. And then he says he predicts spiritual feminism, and he calls it, it's the year of the witch. And he changes it to the book of the witch, and he says the book of the future will be the book of the witch, and that would be New Age literature and what I call spiritual feminism. So he talks about that coming as an effect of the electric age, and the satellites and all that. Then he predicted the rise of the Japanese and electronics manufacturer, all in this speech. And he talks about jazz in the 1920s was the new Tower of Babel because it unified the cultures of the world via a universal language of gesture, not of words. Then it predicts the USA as the beast, the misfit in the global theater, and explains why America is the misfit because its visual bias, it's the only country built on the printing press, and has this extreme visual and kinetic. The kinetic comes in with the industry that America develops in the 19th century. That visual kinetic bias makes it really incompetent in relation to the new electric tactility that Japanese and other less visualized cultures, less affected by the printing press, they're more able to handle the energizing of the tactile space by electricity. So it's a technical expression. I wouldn't put it past McLuhan because he read the Bible every day in five different languages, and he went to Mass all the time. He really put a lot of store in the Bible. And Ion has said that some of the things we get in the Revelation series McLuhan saw or intuited, but he didn't tell anybody. But you can see as a metaphor, he doesn't bring a value judgment in it. He doesn't say that America is a bad monster. He talks about it technically. It is a visually biased culture that is finding it very difficult to figure out its role in the new global theater, the resonant global theater. But privately, it was his metaphor for America being the beast, you know, the cop of the world, and all the problems that America's gotten itself into the last 40 years around the world.
God, his perspective is so huge. It just sounds like he wasn't really here. He was just observing everything and...
Yes, and that's what I found out. Have you heard me talk about how I, of course, in the early days, you'd ask, well, did that person riff ride or parallel world? And he said, yes. And he said McLuhan had two or three other families in other worlds.
Just like you.
Yeah. And he got what... what the point was, like, how did he, whatever it was, I don't know what question led to it, but what McLuhan, Ian goes into it, that what McLuhan noticed as he went around to the different worlds, the common thing in all the worlds was the printing press, which was odd, right? Why would these worlds, all different, slightly different, have this common factor of the printing press? And it's very complex where that goes, that discussion, but that's how he began to notice the media.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, in his PhD thesis, see, he was looking at Finnegan's Wake very early, before it even was published as Finnegan's Wake, because they were looking at it in Cambridge when he went there in 1934. So he said his whole Canadian education in Manitoba was thrown out the window once he got to Cambridge, because they were doing a whole bunch of stuff, and they were the leading edge because it was still the empire, so they had all the, quote, smartest minds academically. So it was a really upset his patterns of what he thought was going on in literature when he went to England, but he really started studying it. He read Wyndham Lewis and Joyce and all this stuff, and so he had a head start in looking at what was really coming out of the art world in the teens and 20s out of Paris and that. You know, back in Toronto in the 40s, the students were not allowed to read Ulysses. It was locked up in the rare book room. See, like in Canada, it's more, censorship is still going on. You know what I mean? So they're not even going to know about Ulysses, Joyce's novel before Finney's Wake, and therefore they're not even have any inkling of Finney's Wake. But McLuhan got all that in England, so he comes back pretty advanced. And when he comes back in 1937, then he goes back to England, and the first he's in Paris and has to run to England on the day the war breaks out. He's on his honeymoon, and they catch the news, and they got the last boat from Calais or whatever over to Dover or England. In September 1939. So he spends a year, or at least till the early summer in 1940, and then he has to take the dangerous boat ride across the Atlantic Ocean to get back to St. Louis where he was teaching. So he then develops his thesis in 40, 41, 42, 43 in St. Louis. But the beginning of the thesis begins with a part of Platonic Dialogues where Socrates is talking and questioning about what names are and what are words. So once I knew the Ion stuff, I said, so McLuhan knew that words were the power. You could say they're the energizer, words. Words are the thing that create your reality and the key to the only thing that's real. And he said, yes. And I said, well, on the surface, you'd never think he said that. But when you actually look at the statement, the medium is a message, and what he said about studying the ecology, the effects of media, including language, that's what Ion would say. Watch your words. So the whole word wisdom that comes out of Ion is implied in McLuhan's PhD.
Maybe a question to Ion would be, are words energy?
Yeah, I think, words are the only thing that are real. And so are words non-physical? And non-physical, it was a stopgap. That was created by fallen people. The totally comprehensive, huge physicalness of an ascended person would be greater than the idea you need a non-physical to keep you going, or you need a guff to have bliss in. So words are greater than the non-physical.
Ooh.
So that sounds like they're, quote, energy.
Ooh, yeah.
See, so by saying this, it changes your images, the ratios of proportions you have in your mind, right?
Of your physical and your non-physical?
Of those images, yeah. Of your physical. Mm-hmm. Non, we're altering that by saying these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why did Ion equate energy with fat in the body? I mean, was that ever resolved?
I don't think he said that energy was fat. Fat was conductivity.
Well, he said that energy is stored as fat.
Right.
Body.
And he says energy is not the issue, so... Yeah, what's how do you talk yourself out of that one, or make it clear?
I'm looking at the notes here. It says Bob doesn't want to hear about Matthew anymore. Let's see. People maintain weight to be held to earth. That's old news.
There's a point. The printing press brought in the notion of gravity. Downpull. See, that's getting stuck in a container, and it's kind of weighting you down. That's an eye bias, an effective eye bias. You know, pre-litter cultures, especially the Aboriginal, they never thought of making a rocket go to the moon and figure out the measurements of the moon that the rocket shoots off and then lands on the moon. They went to the moon because the moon was in their eyes. There was no distance. You ever see that movie, The Right Stuff? You know, about the jet fighters and breaking the sound barrier. Remember that? And Sam Shepard plays the main astronaut. Remember, it leads up to the moon shot, and these Sam Shepard and the jet guys, they're obsolete, right? They're big in the 40s, 50s, breaking the sound barrier, but then the moon program takes over. Do you remember, I think it was in that movie, they show the rocket, the Apollo mission going off out of Cape Canaveral, and then they show an Aboriginal guy meditating or just resonating with the whole thing. Do you remember that image?
No, I don't remember that.
I don't either.
But that showed it to me. They knew what was going on, and they were even saying these damn white men are going to upset the ecology by putting this tin can on the moon. Because the Aboriginal guy could go to the moon just like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a great book called Of Water and the Spirit, where it was about the Dogon tribe and the initiation that the Dogon boys had in one African village was included jumping into the water, into a pool of water that actually wasn't there, but knowing that they were going to go into the next world.
That's what they said they were doing.
They did, yeah. The author of this book, that is how they initiated the young men of the tribe. That was what all of them had to do, was jump through. And you had to, you know, he had it's complicated because he was actually kidnapped as a child and raised as a Christian, and had to come back when he was, you know, past the age of when he would have been initiated at 12 and 13. 14, and he was now 16, 18, and he still wanted to do it and needed to do it. So he had more bias that was containing him and controlling him because of seeing the outside world other than his tribe.
Right.
So it was a lot more difficult for him to make those motions with, you know, abandonment, not thinking he wasn't going to hit the ground and, you know, kill himself. But
See, that's the kind of book McLuhan would cite. He'd say, this book shows the conflict between the cultures. Here's a guy who's been visualized, made a visual bias, and he goes back to the tactile reality of the Aboriginals and the sensory conflict. That's exactly the kind of book McLuhan loved. And he talked about the Dogon in the early 70s when they kind of were, that research or those books started coming out and people talked about it. And he was struck that the word for language in the Dogon tribe was weaving. It meant weaving. And he was looking at the electric media as increasingly, he predicted the internet and that environment, the seamless web of electric information. And then he saw all technology's words. So you have words electrified are weaving the global theater. And then the Dogon, their term for words was weaving. So he found those kind of patterns interesting.
That's profound.
Another one. That's the third profundity we've created today.
And I was going to make a joke, so I wasn't in the profound arena.
Oh, please, make the joke. Make the joke.
Well, I was going to say, it's funny to think of being kidnapped by Christians as this horrible thing. You know, it's like being, or you said they were being raised by Christians. Yeah, it's like being raised by wolves. Being raised by wolves is preferable to being raised by Christians.
Well, the primitive peoples, you know, pre-literate peoples, we consider the visually biased person as a monster. And McLuhan used to quote, in the medieval period, when the people were not literate, they lived in a manuscript culture, but they did not engage with the manuscript. They were largely oral and tactile, but they were forced to be social, to operate in social institutions that the elites brought in that were visually biased, right? So they were slightly visual biased. But back then, they used to call a person who could read a warrior with an eagle beak, something like that. They definitely, the peasants walking around would be quite intimidated or on guard when a book reader came around. And that's what the literate man lost sight of. They lost sight of how each new medium is a big, big revolution in sensibility, upsets previous sensibilities, But pre-litter people, they are more sensitive to that because they haven't been made numb and put in the visual container space of space, time, and gravity that the literate effect creates.
And it's very limiting. The literate.
Well, it's interesting. Now that's the theological question. Why did Christ embed his message in the phonetic alphabet? Why did Christianity go around the world? Why is this the final achievement of the fall? Then you go back to, well, why did humans fall? For the experience. You can't knock the unique experience that literacy gave us. And it led to all this technology being invented, and because we were numb, the technology wasn't gotten rid of. You know, there's the famous Baghdad battery back, 500 BC or whatever. There's somebody invents the electric battery and he brings it to the emperor and he shoots the guy because he knew that this would change everything. So we wouldn't have had any of the technologies we have today, which some people would say are not a service. They make us stupid and dumb and numb. But others, if they're you take a JW, he loves his technology. You know, he has an ascended perspective on it. He's not afraid of it. He's not limited by it. So you can have your cake and eat it too. So you wouldn't have got this technology until we were numb by literacy and then didn't know that machines caused effects, and we just said, steam ahead, make more inventions, progress. That was an illusion caused by the printing press. No tribal society would have fallen for that. That's why the Chinese never implemented the printing press across the board to make it a horizontal medium. They just used it for painting or calligraphy because they were not affected by the phonetic alphabet, which creates the sense of visual dominance, and you got to occupy Wall Street. That's a huge visual bias. These are literate Americans demanding a fragmented job.
Worky job.
Yeah, imagine trying to tell them what I'm just saying now. Explain to them how this whole movement is expressing it's American fundamentalism. You're actually defeating the 99%er, which is the rest of the world, which are not visually biased. You guys are hoiking up and being 1%ers because the hierarchy the visual space brought in creates a division between 1% and the 99%. All right? So they're actually the opposite of what they claim to be. Now, there's no way they'd believe or understand my explanation. But if you took time to study what I'm saying, to study, hear a little bit of Ion, my explanation is not so far off if you took the time to get it.
Yeah, I wonder if they would get it, if some of them would get it.
There would be one or two. We have one right here on the McLuhan and Maui conference we got happening right here. Miroslav Bites showed up, or Bits. He's Ukrainian-American, and he's here for 2.5 weeks. And we have in physical interactions and seminars about this McLuhan stuff because he was at the New School of Social Research and just feeling he wasn't getting an education. And then when he discovered Buzz Kostin's videos, which have a lot of my spoken stuff, he then got interested in McLuhan and then my stuff, and now he wants a full briefing of McLuhan, and he's very keen on it. But I was thinking he's an example of someone from Occupy Wall Street. There'd be one or two people who would be intrigued and come and talk to me, but then they would have to deal with the fact they'd be intimidated about how much apparent work they'd have to do to get it. See, that's what intimidates people. So Miroslav, he enjoyed our dialogues and all that, but then he said, I think he's supposed to be presenting papers, like we're pretending this is an academic conference, and it always ends up me explaining a lot to him, so he doesn't get to talk that much, and he likes listening, and he's learning a lot, but he said, I think we should start making an audio artifact, a project. I'm going to use my ability to take quotes and verbal stuff and make them a musical collage. So he shifted over into making an artifact, a project, rather than putting up with me talking to him every other day.
Maybe you could just whisper to him, Bob, say, don't worry, Ion says when Bob gets it, everybody gets it.
Yeah, I'm the last guy.
You're the last guy.
Yes, nothing's going to happen until Bob gets it. So actually, I like to say that I'm the avant-garde, and Ion showed up to the most leading edge of awareness, but he actually showed up to the last guy that we can't change the world until Bob gets it, because he's the stupidest one around.
Oh, that makes me think about Genesee and the steps. When we learn the steps of how we've fallen, maybe
yeah.
we could figure out how to get back.
Yes.
As you said, it was an important thing to have happen.
To get back.
Well, I guess it, or was it to fall? I don't know.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm not sure. So you're saying there are the steps, and why did you say get back?
Because what I heard was Ian said, you know, if I can, maybe it's important for me to explain to you how you fell so that maybe you could look at it and walk the steps back.
Oh, that's what Ian said?
Mm-hmm. That's what I heard.
Oh, okay.
I'll always,
yeah,
always phrase it that way. That's what I heard.
He was probably under my onslaught of questioning, but why are we doing that? This was his doing this analysis of the Bible. That was his explanation. So you can retrace the steps. So you got to know the steps that happened.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what... Now, look, you read McLuhan's art criticism in the early 50s. That's exactly what he said art was. Retracing the effects of a big epiphany. And he also said it was... another way he said it was retracing the stages of apprehension and finding out the quiddity, which means the essence of the moment, that aesthetic moment, and then finding the way to express that aesthetic moment in some artistic form. But that's why I have on the tiny note chart the stages of apprehension. The retracing aspect is probably all through art, including primitive art, which was ritual. It wasn't until the Greeks brought in the private identity and the private effect of the phonetic alphabet, which creates the object, that creates the art object. All the purposes of art before the phonetic alphabet was ritual, rebuilding the cosmos. And then as writing came in, the beginning of a civilized, or the effect of letters and writing on that ritual archetype, was the mysteries. To go to a, you know, a cave or a hidden place and take some drug or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then that becomes embedded in the literate ritual of Christianity. That's the mass, taking the wine of Jesus. So, but yeah, no, that's the replaying of the stage of apprehension. Now, that's another example of you quoting what Ion said, and I already read that for 40 years in McLuhan.
Hey, Sheila, do you see art that way? I mean, have you heard of it or viewed it that way? I'm just curious.
No. What was the phrase you said, Bob, that actually got my attention?
the color is not a visual medium.
No. Just recently. It was about reenacting the cosmos.
Oh, what I just said, what I said a couple minutes ago.
Yeah.
Primitive.
Yeah,
art.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can read a book called The Gates or Gate of Horn, done by this, I think, female anthropologist, where she traces all the art, the beginning of the arts in Greek society, and shows how they're echoes of all the pre-literate society's rituals. Because art was McLuhan says we retrieve that. He said Joyce saw that we retrieve the ancient condition of a collective participation in making the society. So, you know, ancient tribes, they would every day bring the sun up. They knew they had to bring the sun up, or they felt they had to. That's deep proprioceptive involvement in visual space. You carve it, you sculpt it. Well, today, people listen to the radio, listen to media, and phone in talk shows. Every day, you got this across the globe. Everybody's creating the day by participating in the information overload environment. We're creating an electrified replay of the ritual of primitive man. So that's and Joyce saw that. I mean, I don't know if I have time, but I can go over to Dupes and I'll read you some of these quotes where McLuhan explains Joyce. But you guys talk for a minute, see if I can find it. But you quiz each other or whatever.
Because
I don't know if I can.
What other notes did you have on that cash flow, Allison? Because
let's
just see. That whole thing about energy and body weight and fat.
Well,
I'm still not.
I had it. Yeah.
I'm still not really. I haven't really grasped it fully.
That's what I was going to say. Is that it? What the notes I have is that we talked a lot about it, but it felt like at the end of the conversation nobody was really clear. And
right.
James didn't get it, and we didn't get it. But it felt like it was just all from this, because it was such a huge toppling of what we had thought we knew
mm-hmm.
about fat,
mm-hmm.
that it takes a lot to go back in and look at it. And that what I have is, let's see, it says...
And Ian says, you know, don't desire energy. You know, when you're
right, because you already
energy,
have enough.
Yeah, when Ian says you got more non-physical than you could ever use, you don't operate on any idea of lack, because you couldn't be lacking if you're eternal. There's no lack possible. And you've always been here, and there's no beginning or end.
But desiring isn't coming from a sense of lack. That's wanting. That's the difference in using words. So,
well, do you remember, this is the key point, Sheila. You remember Ian was all about 3-2-1-ing and manifesting your desires. Do you remember about a year into that, which would be about a year ago, Ian shocked everybody by saying we're not supposed to have desire? Do you remember that? And people were thrown by that. It was said on a cash flow.
No, I don't ever remember that, because he would say that it's all about desires.
Right, and he canceled that one day. Because, as usual, Ian will eventually cancel every, quote, truism, unquote, that he seems to be saying. Because they always become a cliche and then become a prop and a source of energy. And that's not what you should have. Nothing should be a source of energy for you.
Go ahead. Energy is something you just don't put your attention on at all.
Right. You got too much of it. Already got too much.
It is the only thing that exists.
That's right. And that's why, you know, humans, they get fed up with having too much energy, so they off themselves to specialize in one aspect of energy, which is bliss. So they create the gap to go and have an intense experience of bliss, because they couldn't handle the nebulous flow of eternal too much energy feeling. That's suicide.
Oh, wait, I just got something here when we were talking about it, that if, you know, as you said, if everything is energy, fat equals energy. Electricity equals energy. Everything is just movement is energetic movement. Right?
Right.
It's constantly oscillating.
Well, that's it. Say oscillating. Because to say something is one word, energy, that's what McLuhan called the univocal approach. You don't want to say it's energy. I used to object to people saying it's all vibration or all frequency. It isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I eventually lately brought in other factors to break up the univocal emphasis on one word. It's not frequency. It's about frequency, interplay with magnetism, polarity, and conductivity, and vectors. That's what you say.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone said, what's it all about, Bob? Well, it's about frequency, magnetism, polarity, conductivity, and vectoring. They go, what? Isn't it just about frequency? No, that's only one-fifth of the thing. You got to have all five.
Well, that's why, I mean, fat is energy. That's what I was saying. Other things are energy. To try to limit fat to one thing.
Yeah.
Maybe what we're asking is, Sheila, what is fat? Not what...
Yeah, remember, cavemen didn't know they had feet. They didn't even know they had bodies. We're working within known visual images of a framework called a body.
Yeah.
That's a limitation right off.
It just doesn't seem relevant anymore. It's like, it's whatever it is. It's just, you got a lot of it or you don't.
No, you don't. You don't think you don't notice you've got less contrast.
Yeah.
Call it less contrast.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have energy. I got less contrast. It's strangely dim.
Oh, what's the latest one now that he said to say, Sheila, was that Ian was like, okay, just I spend my stored energy every day. Or...
Okay.
What was the quote? I spend, let's see if I wrote it down. Do you remember it, Bob?
If you're trying to lose weight, is it that's what you would say? Or even if you don't, you just say, I spend my.
Was it said during today, this show we're doing, November 30th?
Yeah. was.
Okay, I haven't heard the show yet, so I don't know. I haven't redone it, so I'm not.
Let me go back to this. I'll see if I can.
Okay, while you're doing that, I found the quote.
Up.
If you,
okay.
I want you to listen to this, so don't look too much. Here's the quotes I'm thinking of. These were written in the early 50s in McLuhan's essays on James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake, when he was able to go public with how he figured out Finnegan's Wake. Here's one quote. Necessarily, therefore, all artistic imitation first arose from the pagan liturgies or mysteries. If Daedalus was the first to note this relation, James Joyce was the first to see in these ancient rituals of descent and return the perfect externalization in drama and gesture of the stages of human apprehension. The retracing of any moment of cognition will thus provide the unique artistic form of that moment. And that moment's art form coincides with the moment's quiddity, except that the artist arrests what is otherwise fleeting. So then another quote, same era, he says, any movement of appetite within the labyrinth of cognition is a minotaur, minotaurs in quotes, which must be slain by the hero artist. There's desire being slain. Anything which interferes with cognition, whether concupiscence, pride, imprecision, or vagueness, is a minotaur ready to devour beauty. So that Joyce not only was the first to reveal the link between the stage of apprehension and the creative process, he was the first to understand how the drama of cognition itself was the key archetype of all human ritual, myth, and legend. And thus he was able to incorporate at every point in his work, Finnegan's Wake, the body of the past in immediate relation to the slightest current of perception. Now, isn't that an amazing paragraph?
God.
That's very clever how they brought,
Now, if you want to see this, you go to Dupes, go to page 3 at the top, where you got the third page of stickies before you get to the new thread. It's right at the top where it says McLuhan. You go into that and just go down about two-thirds, you'll see these quotes. I'm going to read you another one. He says, Aristotelian mimesis confirms the James Joyce approach.
Oh, my God.
Aristotle's all about... Yeah, Aristotle was all about mime. You mime when you learn. You learn through imitation. Babies do this. Aristotelian mimesis confirms the James Joyce approach, since it is, this mimesis idea, is a kind of recap of natural processes, whether of making sense via cognition or of making a house by following the lines of nature. And then here's another interesting. Talk about doubleness or parallelism. Biogeneticists say today that a growing organism, at every point in its growth, has to know what the whole organism is doing in order to develop. See, that's why people tune into the radio and the news every day to find out, get an image of what the whole society is doing before they can figure out their particular task. So biogeneticists take this idea and say that a growing organism, at every point in its growth, has to know what the whole organism is doing in order to develop. The consequences of the images are the images of the consequences. This involvement and polarity, knowing and growing, is both creative and destructive. See, I can see echoes of Ayn in there.
Yeah.
You know, but you also engage in growing. The fall into visual space and the Ark of the Covenant was the growing part of creating new experience while you already knew the big picture anyways. Mm-hmm. But then you get lost with the printing press, you get lost in the growing, the progress, the development of new technologies, and forget the eternal knowing.
Which is where we are now, right?
Well, we're waking up now because
the...
No, we're waking up now because, and that's the method, meaning of Finnegan's Awake, we're waking up now because visual space is not dominant anymore. We've been in electric space for 100 years, so it's been the most violent century, the most incredible in terms of variety of cultures and experiences and new media. So that cannot be contained in the old visual sense. So that's why among the New Age you'll say, well, the Age of Aquarius began in 1926. Some people say 1926. Some people say 1945. Some people say 67. Some people say 2012 or something, right? But it's all just visual marking of a fact. It's already happened. So Teilhard de Chardin said electricity extended is a major biological event to the point it shifts all the images and empties the image of the guff we have. So we are in a new turbulent waking state, and because it threatens everybody's identity, you got the most number of people dying in this century. you know, in major wars and disasters and plagues and chemical pollution.
So I just got a flash that the art that we're looking at now that's taking us back to the, I can't phrase it the McLuhan way, back to the beginning or back,
yeah.
The fractal.
The fractal is a balancing or a
the way
is
art
a fulcrum.
Is headed into that kind of a organized.
No, no. You're thinking of the
fractal view.
Can you hear me? Which, I'm talking.
No, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, that's
you're
interesting.
No,
I'm not.
Can you hear him, Sheila?
I can hear him.
I couldn't hear
you.
Would,
yeah, it's funny. You went on. I mean, it was okay
no.
what you were saying, but I was responding to what you were saying. And
anyway. I'd rather have you respond. I couldn't hear you.
Right. For some reason, you were so into your thought, you just blocked your ears.
No, I blocked you out like Renee did, huh? Okay, go
yeah.
ahead. Yeah.
Okay.
What did you
now,
have to say about that?
We say a few of the words. I've lost it. What?
I was just talking about the art of today being fractal.
Oh, yeah, the fractal. You're thinking of the fractal that's popularized where you see the repeating image,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
That is not the fractal that Ion's talking about. The fractal
I know that.
Is
I was
an,
just talking about art, though.
Yeah, yeah, but... The fractal, if we're going to talk about it, it's an antenna, and that's more along what McLuhan talks about than the visual image you have of the repeating macro-micro thing that is the popular image. So, no, it's not like a fractal. It's like anamorphosis. It's a trompe-l'oeil is more accurate.
Mm.
It's a trompe-l'oeil. It's a visual pun. And you'll hear McLuhan talk about the pun and all that. And I remember back then saying to an English professor, no, it's not. The Bible got it wrong. It was in the beginning was the word. It should have been in the beginning was the pun, because the pun is multidimensional. And you'll hear McLuhan explaining the accuracy of what I'm saying. He wasn't saying with that sentence, but if you understand him, he talks about the multi-level use of the pun or the implication of the pun, and that's why Joyce built his whole book on a pun. So I'm just objecting to the fractal image.
Okay.
And then here's another quote. I mean, we're talking about desire. Remember what I just said. Any movement, quoting McLuhan, any movement of appetite within the labyrinth of cognition is a minotaur which must be slain by the hero artist. You see, you kill your senses, you kill your addiction to the limited physical by a notion of the non-physical, but that's not to refute, which is the Puritan mistake, is to refute your senses. That ends up like a Gnostic idea of condemn the world of matter. You return to the world of matter with a fuller, richer involvement with it, but you're not hypnotized by it.
Mm.
So look at this. Talking about what happened in the 20th century, McLuhan says, in contrast to private awareness, social consciousness is a process of scrapping, retrieving, and probing. So that's what the 20th century is. He says, the emphasis for the most part is upon retrieval and the accumulation of vast residues. With the development in the 19th century of many new technologies or cliches, the supremacy of unified print consciousness gave way to multi-consciousness. There was no garbage heap, no midden heap. There was no unconscious large enough to contain all of the materials generated by the breakdown of so much probing and environing. Yeah, now imagine if you guys got this taught to you in art school and not the ridiculous shit
wow.
you got in art school.
Wow.
So this is what quotes like this, I see that's what Ion's saying. Now, maybe I'm just translating into McLuhan's stuff, but do you know any other philosopher, or religious stuff that's as complicated as Ion is and that approaches that and understands the return to the eternal return and all these factors, which are mythologized and made into a big deal by people like Joseph Campbell? They miss the practical element. McLuhan's always keeping it practical by pointing out that the immediate technological environment is creating these patterns. See, the unconscious is not some, as Ion says. Now, there's another. That might have been one of the original, it's just occurring to me now, one of the original ideas that Ion was saying that I said, that's McLuhan-esque. He would say, the unconscious is not this inky, misty, mysterious zone that controls you, right? He said that, and he had some other cliches about the unconscious. He says, that's not true. And I said, that's what McLuhan says. McLuhan says your immediate environment is your unconscious, what you're not attending to, what you're not noticing. And especially on the macro level, people don't notice the huge effects of huge media environments like the printing press or the electric age, they're not attending to that. Therefore, it's their unconscious. But it's not a mystical unconscious. It's a practical unconscious.
You're saying what you don't put your attention on is your unconscious?
Yeah. What you're not noticing, and that's exactly what Ion's always saying. You're not noticing that 90% of yourself is non-physical. You're not noticing the shifts during the day into other worlds.
I do sometimes. Haha.
Yeah, now that Ion said it, we can hear it, it becomes real.
Mhm. I'm just looking at my notes about the energy portion. It says eat and don't give attention to energy.
Yeah. It's always for sensory pleasure, enjoying the physical, but it's an expanded notion of the physical. It's not a physical defined by what you can see.
So how are we supposed to rest when we, because this has happened a lot, week for weeks for me, not every night, but I wake up in the morning tired. I'm like, oh, man, where did I go? What did I do? So it's like one night I went to bed and I said to myself, all right, look, I actually want to not feel tired when I get up in the morning, so I don't want to go to all these places. Have a night off. I mean, what? So if it's not energy that you're desiring, and you've gone to and traveled all these places and done all these things in other worlds while you're sleeping, when is one supposed to rest? I guess is the question.
When does one arrive at rest?
When does one arrive at rest?
Yeah, that's another way of saying it, because yeah, I mean, Ion says, doesn't it, he goes on about wherever you go, you take what you are here, you take it to where you go, right?
Right.
So if you got some turmoil going on, no rest, you will take it to the other worlds. So it's energy is not having that contrast draining you, or that's what energy should be, but forget energy. The rest, inertia. I want inertia, right? Give me inertia.
The still point. Help.
Yeah, the still point in the middle of the turning cosmos. Tranquility. So what you're conflicting about is probably dealing with lack. It's always lack and wanting and desiring and appetite and then lack. That's the oscillation that Krishnamurti talks about. That's the limitation of being controlled by your physical self and what you think it needs and requires. If you're tired, you're engaged in satisfying your desires. But we're not saying what Buddhism says, get rid of your desire, because that's a desire in itself. So it's always give it up, never mind.
Aren't you actually engaged?
What did Sheila say?
Going to separate me from my desires, thank you very much. I'm quite happy with them, and I like having some, and they're fun.
Well, that's what you're complaining about. You're satisfying your desires. You're losing your poise,
all
your
right.
Inertia.
So I should desire being rested?
Yeah.
Well, now, wait a minute. It's the lack. What if it's, Sheila, it's the view of thinking that you need rest to feel good?
Yeah. You can't state what you want. Well, that's an interesting point. You're supposed to state what you want and get it, but you can't do it from a lack. That's why Ion says, you don't.
Oh,
it's all just nouns. Don't put verbs into it. Whatever you say is.
Yeah.
Well, you just need to say rest, and you'll have it. Say inertia.
Rest!
That sounded like a little bit of desire in there.
Desire, as long as it's not from lack. Yeah.
Well, what's the difference? Like what?
The difference is I would love to enjoy lobster dinner, but it's like, oh my God, I feel so less than because I'm not having lobster this month or this week or something. It's different. It's like it's a place of enjoyment and the pleasure as opposed to not
requiring it.
Yeah.
Wanting more of what you already have.
For more.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you declare you want rest or inertia, you then also have to say, I don't give a fuck if I ever get it.
I know, I get that line. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't want it. You got to be happy where you are. You already got everything.
Yeah. I get it. I'm I'm perfectly happy where I am, and I'm ready for more.
And where you are is not what it looks like. Don't go by your eyes. You're not in Savannah.
I'm not. Okay.
So you
you're still in Paris. You're still
okay,
in Dublin. Well. You're still in Paris. You're still in Rhode Island. You're everywhere you ever were. You still are. So whatever images you have of the lacks of those environments and bad memories, drop them.
Well, that's
or
good
Indiana.
Advice.
Oh, this is, she liked that. Mikey liked that. Oh, that was good advice. Note that, people. Where? How many hours have we been talking? And we're at the, about 90 minutes into it. Sheila accepted some words from Bob.
So do you want to hear James talking
yeah.
about...
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. Let me just finish before we do that. A couple more of these quotes. They're just so amazing. Let's see... McLuhan talked about the garbage apocalypse in that June 69 speech. So here's a reference to that in from his book, Cliched Archetype. The present probe tests cliché as the current technology and the archetypal world as the rag and bone shop, that's in quotes, of old perceptions and techniques. In the electric age, there are far too many clichés available for retrieval. The paradoxical result is the end of garbage or of the rag and bone shops. As we tend to extend consciousness itself by the new technology, we probe all, scrap all, in a deluge of fragments of cultures for creativity. That's what's going on. That's what IOM points to when you're truly ascended. You'll be doing that. Or not. Indifferently. But you can do it.
Scrap it all.
Beg your pardon? Allison?
I just said scrap it all.
And then wallow around in it. Because you can't get rid of anything once it's been created.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just shifting a perspective and ratios. The idea, okay, I'll put this over here and I can engage in this other thing over there. You pretend to shift things around and create ratios of attention. But nothing
preference.
Is totally obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
what
I want to end
say,
with this.
Oh, sorry.
No, I was just saying we'll include the rest.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, I'm in.
All right, so here I'll end with this. This is a quote from page 18 of Finnegan's Wake, which sums up everything. Here's James Joyce. Listen to this. In the ignorance that implies impression, that knits knowledge, that finds the name form, that whets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweeten sensation, that drives desire, that adheres to attachment, that dogs death, that bitches birth, that entails the ensuance of existentiality. Isn't that neat?
Wow.
That's the whole process we're talking about. When you're ignorant, when they made the Ark of the Covenant, they did it in a state of ignorance, and they created an impression. The artifact made them put their power in it. In their ignorance. So look at this. In the ignorance that implies impression that knits knowledge. They developed a whole bunch of knowledge around the idea the Ark contained their power and not themselves. And so that then they found the name form. They found God, the name God, that whetted the wits, that conveyed contacts, that sweetened sensation, that drove desire, that adhered to attachment, that got pissed off about death, or as it says here, dog's death, that bitch's birth. See, it assumes it began somewhere and it's going to end. That entails the ensuance of, like, existentiality. Of just drift, maybe. And McLuhan says that whole sentence is Joyce setting up the chain of cognition and recognition, or cognition and recognition itself.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, you know, very dense statements I'm reading, cram-packed with the whole process that we're talking about.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
they're amazing, though. They're
I'll send them to you.
I'm going to
cut and paste this section, and I'll send them to you.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I could do it now while we're... Can you look at your email now while you guys
uh-huh.
are on the phone?
Can you, Sheila?
I'm painting. You're going to interrupt my painting?
She'll have to look later.
Yeah. What she says she's paging? What's that mean?
Painting.
Oh, painting. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I won't do that now. Okay, let's hear James.
Okay, hold on.
What are the factors that make them feel heavy, look heavy, or get heavy?
What are the factors? What are those factors? What are those factors? What? Let's see. What are those factors? And those factors are what? Okay, wait a minute. Okay, you have somebody that's overweight. They have a lot of excess fat. And you're saying fat is stored energy. Somebody says, well, they decide, I don't want to be fat anymore. I want to lose this fat. You're saying that fat on there is stored energy.
No, wait. If they said that, we'd say eat.
Eat.
Okay.
Then they decide
because,
to eat. Okay,
because, we're going to finish this.
But wait. Why can you go, wait? That's fucking James. Had enough of your interruptions.
You would say to this person that's obese, go ahead and eat more or continue to. That's not the problem. I'm saying if somebody's obese and they have a desire or they verbally say with their words, I want to lose weight, I want to lose this excess fat and have muscle. And then they decide, okay, then I'm going to have to get rid of this so they're going to burn energy. And then they say, I don't have any energy to walk up the stairs. But you're saying all the fat is stored energy. How come suddenly they don't have that energy and can burn it? And it becomes a big effort and they can't even move.
Okay.
But they have stored energy in their fat.
Good.
Yeah, good question.
Good. They're storing it. They're not using it.
Well, how
can
they
don't... You can have a tank. You can have a tank full of gas in your car. Want more energy in your car, so you put tanks of gas cans in your trunk. Okay,
right.
You can run out of energy on the side of the road and have fuel in your trunk. Okay, but you're storing that fuel. You want to, and you're saying, describe how to burn the fuel, how to get access to the fuel, and we'd say, well, the only way to do that is to eat, because you could take those cans from the gas tank and fill your car up, or you could stop at the gas station and fill up your tank and drive real fast, and it will make that gas that you're storing not necessary. It would make it obsolete. So your body then would be kind of the same thing is true if you go to the gas
station. Wait. Use a different metaphor. You're talking about a metal and a creator. You use your word creator. That creator wants to get rid of this excess. And, you know, they go to a dietitian and say, well, you got to up your calories and exercise more. And then they say, well, I don't have any energy, so they eat more, right? And
we never say exercise. We never say exercise. No, we don't say exercise.
What if they want to? And they don't have enough energy because there's too much fat and their heart rate goes up and they get breathless and they can't move.
Well, no, that's what happens to those stately, svelte runners when they run the marathon across the finish line and then their heart stops beating. That's what that's about.
What, exercise is opposed to that? See, what's that
referred to?
That's exercising?
Exercise.
You don't say.
That's a magnesium deficiency.
You agree with Carolyn on that? You agree with Carolyn on that statement?
Granted.
So, wait a minute.
But he
said it's not relevant, Carolyn.
So, James, are people
want to feel better. That's the end of the road where they want to go. They have excess fat. You're saying it's stored energy. They want to feel good. Okay, you're saying, go ahead, you can continue to eat the calories, and they, in their head, somehow the weight doesn't go. I'm not saying that's the rule. I'm sure some people, they lose weight when they eat, and they end up looking like Schwarzenegger. But what is that? They want to feel better, and they don't have enough energy to get rid of the fat. So how does somebody do it then?
You're tangling up fat with energy or lack of it. The most tired people in the world are the very, 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 very svelte bodybuilders. They're more tired than the fat people.
Yeah, because they sit around between weightlifting stints at the gym and just sort of lounge. Then they go and do some exercises. Then they lounge, right? Is that what you mean? Not really doing anything else. Well, if they have to get massages, they have to get...
Yeah, but they have the energy to lift the barbell.
They have less fat people watching television.
And why is that? Why do they have no energy?
Because they're not storing it, they're burning it.
Well, how should they get their energy back then? How could they overcome that? What would you recommend they do?
Eat and don't give intention to energy.
And not wait.
I enjoy my food and I burn every bit of energy that I have.
No, no. Are you saying do they continue weightlifting?
And if they choose to, then you'd have to go to the reason of why they're weightlifting in the first place. Some fellas go to the weight body to the gym so they can get naked and show off their pretty sport model. If that's what they're doing it for.
Right.
So you got to go to this purpose for their going to exercise or do this work.
They don't care if they have energy or not, long as they are displaying themselves.
And have the ability to show off their self. Right. Good. But, James, it's the same thing is true if you plan a trip to go to the desert. Okay? You plan a trip, you're going on vacation, you're going to the desert. Guess what happens? Your body will naturally start holding water. Because the going of the desert is a very dry, arid place. So your body knows this and will automatically retain water, fluid. So you'll have extra to not wither or dehydrate in the desert. Some people find that same thing in an airplane. They'll swell a little in an airplane. That pressurization makes them retain fluid.
Their body understands what their mind is intending. The mind says, I'm going to the desert. No, we know what to do about that.
Right.
They respond to the imagery of your mind.
No.
Yeah, it just,
they just know.
What does it respond to? The fact you said it, or the fact you think of it, or they don't even respond?
Said it.
They just said it. Okay, if you said it, it responds. So everything is being taken care of. Okay, Renee, go ahead.
I have a question. I was taking the RNA.
So I want to stop there.
Okay. Wow, that was pretty interesting.
Wasn't that interesting?
Yeah, it was funny. It was. That's the wait. Why can you say wait?
Now do you remember my email?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of, your email about that.
Yeah. Anyway, that was...
What
did you get
one thing,
out of that?
Did you say, what did I get?
Mm-hmm.
He said burning energy was a negative thing. But then later he said that they burn energy in the gym. Did you catch that? And it was something like energy is something burnt. It seemed to be a limiting notion.
Well, the metaphor with the water, though, holding the water, I think what they're saying is you're holding on to, you know, you're. If you're not saying with your words, I burn every bit of energy that I have, you're going to store it.
So you why do you have to have the concept of energy and then burning it? He's saying forget energy, so what are you burning?
Because I think we constantly say we don't have enough or we want more or the words have created... Maybe if we pay attention to actually what we are saying about it, you know, or during the day, you know, you might not even recognize that you're saying, oh, man, you wake up, Sheila, from Parallel Worlding or something, and you say, God, I don't feel rested. I really wish I had more energy. I'm not saying you say that, but if that were an example. Mm-hmm. And then you store energy, but you've never said the words about burning it. Because of our society, we're constantly, you know, as James brought up later, so all those energy drinks people are drinking and all the energy bars that they're taking and all the discussion about energy is just piling it on with piling the gas tanks into your trunk.
Right. You're interpreting a feeling. When you get up in the morning, you got to reinterpret that feeling. Declare that you don't feel tired. Don't take that feeling literally.
And everything is literal. Yeah.
No, everything isn't literal because everything is not. So you can see through everything. Yeah, I'm just saying if you start declaring.
Ion says they take everything literally, and I because if you're declaring what it is you want, to, you know, if you declare those words.
Oh, yeah, if you mean that.
I am burning energy, yeah.
If you mean that, what did I say that made you say that you need to balance
because
it by
said,
saying?
Don't take it literally. You said
don't
take what you're saying literally.
Yeah, don't say it, I guess. Don't take it literally. No, it was a new idea. Do not take your feelings literally.
So you really don't feel that. I get it. Sheila, you don't feel tired when you get up.
Yeah. That's something duping you. Now we're getting into narcissism. You got a demon inside you. And then we have to figure out how to get rid of it. But we don't want to go that way. So
that is a good question, though, because it's about a feeling place. Remember when we used to all
be
talking about a feeling place?
And
that was back in 3-2-1 days.
Like Sheila, get rid of the idea that you're waking up. You never went to sleep. Remember that big one? That was one of the first big breakthroughs for Allison when she heard that we never sleep. No one's ever slept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're looking to create an experience of sleep or inertia and not feel tired because you've got this idea that you are going to other worlds, which is the truth. You are not sleeping. So you got to get rid of the desire to have sleep.
Well, or the idea that you need sleep.
Yeah, that you need sleep, that you need the disconnect.
Just like we think we need energy.
Right.
And that energy comes from food.
Yeah, I go to bed every night with no need to go to bed. I'm not tired or anything. But I'll, as I say, go to bed to be polite. Get out of Carolyn's hair when she gets up in the morning. I'm not around. And I go to sleep right away. I don't even know why I go to sleep or I go unconscious or I go to another world. Like, you know, you'd think you'd have to lay there and get tired or something. But it's like, okay, time to switch. And I switch off. And then I wake up and I'm usually fresh. Occasionally I'll get tired. But usually it's like, well, what'd we do that for? I don't know. Let's just carry on now.
So I hear you. I've started to do that. When I go to lie down now, I just am very aware that I go other places. So now I say, okay, I'd like to go to the place I was the night before and because I can remember where it was.
Yeah.
I don't always go to that place, but I notice where I'm going somewhere else, and then I wake up. Wake up isn't the right word. I open my eyes again, or I don't even open my eyes, but I come back, you know, something will happen. I'll turn over and I'll come back from wherever I'd been. And then I say to myself again, okay, I'd like to go out again. Because otherwise I'm going to lie there awake all night.
Yeah. Are you going to bed tired?
Not anymore.
Right. And you too, Sheila? You go to bed not tired?
I go to bed tired.
Right, so you think you're doing something all day.
Yeah, but Sheila's thinner than I am, so she's spending her energy somewhere.
Well, that's the painting. That's the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of sex, you know. Sheila's very engaged in the sexual world.
Maybe when I'm parallel worlding.
What'd you say? What'd you say?
I said maybe when I'm parallel worlding.
Right, you're not noticing it in this world too much. I'm just trying to build up your profile for the fans of House Gagas to turn you into the.
Not as much as I'd like.
Not as much as I like. See? So you know, I'm thinking of, don't think of sleep as going away and coming back. You're just shifting. See, going away, you're not going anywhere. There's nowhere to go because everything is all part of a resonant tactile whole. So big now. So even the idea is you're going away and coming back, I didn't use those words, but you might want to stop the images that locks you into.
Mm.
You're just shifting. What's the word shift mean? Basically, I consider going to sleep as that. I don't go into it to go to other worlds. I go into to disconnect, to have a mini death, to be go unconscious.
That's what I do as well. I mean, the disconnecting thing.
Yeah. I like the disconnect. And I can't stop the dreams or experiences I think I have, but generally I don't have dreams. So I've blocked my parallel worlding.
Hmm.
I've always never had many awareness of dreams and didn't want them. I wanted to be a nothing.
Aren't you so active? You're so active during the day that you would need, you'd need a whole trunk full of that energy if you're going to be doing it.
No, I need a whole trunk full of nothing. I need the anti-environment. I'm very energized, then I go away from having energy or busyness or enjoyment. So I go into the void, and I like that, and I wake up and ready to go again. And I forgot what I did, as Ayat says. And I do it all over again, as if it's all new. Then I disconnect. So, yeah,
but
the...
I bet the people listening are thinking, okay, is it just that? Is it just that? I enjoy my food and I burn every bit of energy that I have. Those are your words. That's what you get.
But I don't like that idea of burning energy because I don't have energy. I don't require it. I don't even think of it as burning.
Why is burning negative to you or burning?
Because you say burning energy. There's no such thing as energy. So what am I burning? Nothing. So why call it burning? I ain't burning anything. I spend most of my time on the phone. Is that burning energy?
What do you think, Sheila?
Absolutely.
Absolutely what, anyway, Sheila?
Absolutely, it's doing something. It's burning energy. I don't know if you think of it that way. You don't have.
Yeah. What? I go to the burn energy. I walk to the beach and go in the water. I say I better do this or I won't have any energy burnt. So I actually have the wrong concept for when I go to the beach. I think I'm getting away from being on the phone all the time or talking. You know what I mean? I'm going to go out and do something physical. Now, I probably don't think that too strongly, so I'm not even doing it. See, I prefer I don't know anything, don't need to know anything. I can just talk whatever's happening.
I heard that bit of bias, though, in the show where you're like, well, you know, but people need to exercise. You didn't say exercise, but there is this idea that movement has some sort of requirement as far as energy spending goes.
Right, and I wouldn't say it that way. A better way to say it is I've got all my senses. I've got my eyes, ears, nose, feet, movement, kinetic, proprioception, all these different sensory actions, potential, and like McLuhan said, I've got senses. I intend to use them. I intend to use my kinetic sense. That's why I go on a walk, just to include that sense. I'm doing my acoustic, I'm doing my tactile feeling, I'm doing my seeing, which is very low, I don't really notice much, and then I make sure I do a little, give the kinetic sense a moment, and that's the walk to the beach. So if I'm using all my senses every day, that's a balanced, that's a satisfied notion, a satisfying notion.
Hey, you guys, I like the word action. You're acting ion.
Yeah.
Act ion.
Act ion. I'm acting. Act ion.
That's good.
Yeah. So needing exercise, that's not an appropriate term. I have a better way. I've talked myself into a new term. I want to use all my senses during the day, and one of them is kinetic movement. And that's the only reason I do the beach, to give the kinetic movement an experience.
Which is what I was talking about earlier about energy, you know, moving it is internal, external, it's through all your senses, as you said. It's not confined to a kinetic experience.
Right.
And
I wouldn't say I wouldn't say a movement of energy through all my senses. Think of your senses as independent worlds. And you engage the different worlds. Not what is the if you think of moving through, that's like a container. You know, I don't advocate the idea you have of the body that you see. The container idea is the limitation.
That's probably true for the fat or the energy storing too.
Right. So the idea of
you hear people talking about storing energy in their body.
Yeah, that's not an accurate perception and useful. It's not a useful perception. And even the idea of conductivity, that implies something's going through something. When Einstein says, never mind, you're not getting involved in the images that your mind creates of what the parameters are of your environment. I've always tried to discourage that. I mean, I always felt sorry for Carolyn. She went and learned medicine. She had to learn all those limiting images of the body.
She's still okay though, huh?
Yeah, she survived it.
Still better than okay.
She didn't believe any of it. She just adopted language for manipulation of social purposes and to cover up her intelligence background.
To create that conscious welfare or whatever you're calling it.
The cosmic welfare.
Cosmic welfare, that's right. Well, that is true, though, about the Earth. It's interesting about, here we are, we're human creators using our words, not having any idea what our words mean, and using them to our...
With intention.
...disadvantage. Yeah, well, using them and creating something that we are surprised to get.
Yeah.
Because we don't know how to use that word. The fat, the energy, the whole thing. But now that we're learning a different perspective through ION with the languages, again, never minding it is the first step, though. But
yeah. I mean, here's McLuhan's definition of imagination. Imagination is that faculty that's not embedded in any of the senses or any of the extensions of the senses, which are technologies. It's not embedded in any of the actions. That's like a never minding. Now, people think imagination is like ability to work with imagery, make up and align the images up for a story or something. But actually, McLuhan's saying, no, real imagination is a never-minding process, not getting engaged in the senses. And so, therefore, you can play with the senses even more ferociously because you don't identify with them.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way of saying you have no attachment to desire.
Other than fulfilling them.
Other than fulfilling them, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah. So, now, Allison, you got to go.
Sheila. You got that desire in there.
Sheila's going to stay.
Thank God.
Yeah. Sheila's a fundamentalist about maintaining desire. We must use have desire. Yeah, Sheila's definition desires, that faculty not embedded in any of the senses or any extensions of the senses.
Winning. Sheila's winning.
Yeah, winning. Yeah, we haven't used that in a long time, have we? We forgot Charlie.
No, yeah. Where all the other the way it morphed into every other bit of language through ION.
Yeah. Okay, so it's 25-3. You got to go, right, Allison?
I do. I will say goodbye, you guys, and you can keep talking.
Okay, but have we done hour two? Can we go on to hour three next time? There's more about this energy. I don't know. Is there more in that hour?
No, it pretty well ceased, I would say, after that. We're at 51.31 of the hour, so we're pretty close to the end.
Yeah, that's pretty close.
And that's what you wanted to play. You wanted that intense period. Here's James. Rarely does James get in there and make the input, but he's really involved in that section, which is interesting
and
fun.
Yeah, not very happy about that car metaphor, boy.
Right. I have to re-listen to that. I didn't get it all the subtleties, because I was gathering the quotes for you and sending them. So I've sent the quotes to you guys, and you'll see at the end of each quote there's a bunch of letters. They're code, the title of the book and the page. Just ignore those. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But just the quotes themselves. Matter of fact, maybe that might be something to pick up on if you guys read the quotes before we do our next recording. Might have something to come out of that.
That's a good idea. Because they didn't actually, it seemed like, James, like, you were like saying, let's talk about this the next hour, and it never really happened.
Right, right.
We never really talked about fat again. So.
Yeah, because there was an agenda for the third hour. It already was pre-planned for Chad to come in and talk about JW's computer. So, and that's really important in hour three. That shows you how powerful that show was.
Yeah. That's why you played it twice. Sorry, Bill had to get sick.
Yeah, I called up Bill today to see if everything's okay for tomorrow, and he had a cold. So I think he's had a bad week. I don't know if I know he got sick last week, but now it seems he has a cold. But he said that, yes, there would be a show tomorrow. He would be around.
Okay. Yay. All right, you guys, I'm signing off. Thank you. I'll call
okay.
you later. We'll talk about timing later.
Okay, okay. Allison.
Bye.
Yeah, thanks
okay.
a lot. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Okay, so Sheila, shall we end? Or is
yeah,
there some more?
Well, it's not, yeah, no. I mean, it's not a gaga. It's an unbalanced gaga without...
Right. Is there any final thing to say about what we've said?
Nothing comes to my mind.
Okay. Just yeah, it's unbalanced now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got...
It's
I've got
a desire to have it balanced.
Yes. I'm going to go and I got to disconnect the backup speakerphone, and then that'll allow me to stop the recording. Okay.